Welcome to Writer Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis. You can check out my books and social media at mindymcginnis.com and visit the Writer Writer Pants on Fire blog at writerwriterpantsonfire.blogspot.com. Today's guest is Jessica Strausser, editor of Writer's Digest and author of Almost Missed You, which was named to the March 2017 Barnes & Noble Best New Fiction list. Jessica joined us today to talk about how her career in journalism led to a position at Writer's Digest and how that informs her fiction writing. Aspiring writers always find it helpful to hear about how successful authors navigated the query trenches. As the editor for Writer's Digest, you knew better than most what the minefield you were wandering into would be like. Was that kind of insight helpful to you, or was it still intimidating?
A lot of people rightly assume, I think, that it was easier and that I know more intimately the protocol of how things are supposed to work on paper. But I definitely had my own crisis of self-confidence. I think anybody sending out cold queries feels as if they're putting themselves out there. I mean, you are. You're putting yourself out there. You're putting your work out there. But for me, I already had this professional title and reputation, and then I was trying to do something completely different that, honestly, I had no idea if I was any good at it at all. I had been writing in the closet, not really sharing with anyone that I was pursuing fiction writing in my personal time. Mm-hmm. Came time to query, I think a lot of people thought, well, you know lots of agents. Why don't you just call them up and see if they want to look at your stuff? And I actually was focused more on cold querying people I did not know at the beginning because I was so nervous that I was going to embarrass myself. They'd be like, oh, the editor of Writer's Digest is sending a novel. Let's take a look at this. Oh, my, this is shockingly horrible. I really had no idea. So in that respect, it was still intimidating for sure.
I understand. I've been trying, failing, but trying, for about 8 months now to place shorts with Lit Mag. They ask for the little bio when you send in your submission, and it's like, I'm an Edgar Award-winning author of 5 novels. I'm published with HarperCollins, but apparently I can't write a short for the life of me. So I completely understand, because there's this assumption that you should be really good at this.
Right.
And maybe you're not.
Well, I mean, my background is in journalism, right? I went to journalism school, and I followed a pretty straight path through editorial, but also freelance writing, but always nonfiction and essays. I mean, I've never taken a fiction workshop. All of my fiction training has been literally reading every article and every issue of Writer's Digest magazine multiple times over, reading a lot of the books that we publish on the craft of fiction through our Writer's Digest books imprint, and then voraciously reading fiction my entire life, which is true for a lot of people. You don't need to have an MFA or sign up for a fiction workshop, but it wasn't something that I'd ever pursued outwardly or shared with anybody. It's a completely different animal from journalism. It was something new. I struggled with the same self-doubt that anybody did, and I still do, honestly.
No, I totally understand. I feel similarly. I've wanted for a while try to write essays, because I think that that in itself is a particularly challenging medium, and I've actually bought a few books, collections of essays that I would like to read, because I'm like you. I learned to write by reading. I never took any classes. That's how I taught myself to write, was by reading. And so I'm kind of taking the same approach with essay writing, is that I want to see what others have done successfully and train myself. That's a goal of mine, but I feel so overwhelmed by it because it is, as you said, it's a different animal and there's a different skill set, and length has nothing to do with it. I can write a 100,000 word novel and feel fairly confident about it. Mm-hmm. But I think writing a 5,000 word essay, I would be so scared to show it to anyone in that field.
Well, you should pitch me at Writer's Digest, Mindy. I won't tell anyone.
Okay. Maybe I will. Yeah, don't tell anyone. You can email me back and be like, you know what? All those doubts you had, they were spot on.
I would never say that.
let's talk about Writer's Digest. I love it. I am a subscriber and I use the site often. And I'm always directing aspiring authors there. From all the way back to the late 90s, I have the Writer's Digest guides to literary agents.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes. Those are cornerstones for me. I still have them. I have a couple stacks from 97 through 2001 with little notes on the side. Rejected. Rejected. Rejected.
You might need to get an updated one.
I just enjoy flipping those pages and looking at all those things that say rejected.
Well, one day they'll be in a museum and we can see.
That's right.
We can all go through your former office and see who rejected you and who you submitted to.
Oh, I still have all my letters. I was querying in the SASE days, so I still have those. I kept them.
Oh, yes.
Keeps you humble.
I have mine as well.
Writer's Digest is a wonderful resource for writers of all stripes. So what led you to your current position there, and how does it color your approach to writing?
It certainly predates my serious attempts at fiction writing, as I kind of alluded to, and heavily influenced me to give it a go. I do have a journalism background, and I actually started with Writer's Digest as an intern when I was in college at Ohio University. I went to the Scripps School of Journalism there, which at the time was one of the best in the country. I think it still is. I'm from Pittsburgh originally, and so I got into the journalism school there, and my junior year, I just went to a job fair and I applied for an internship with Writer's Digest Books, actually. And I ended up spending a summer learning about book editing, which was something I hadn't had the opportunity to learn about in college, which was really interesting. But at the time, even then, I really had my eye on the magazine. I was a magazine major, actually. They invited me to apply for a position about halfway through my senior year. I hadn't even started applying for jobs yet. My goal at the time was to move to New York City or Chicago, someplace that you think of having a lot of magazines to work at. And Writer's Digest is here in Cincinnati, where nothing else is. But it was a family-founded company, founded here in 1920, and that's where we still are. We do have a New York office now, but we're still in Cincinnati. And so they contacted me halfway through my senior year and said, we have something opening up at the magazine, and we'd really like for you to apply. I ended up getting a job here straight out of college, and I was an hourly paid editorial assistant. My job largely consisted at first of faxing people their galleys before the articles were published. So
wow.
This was before we emailed galleys as PDFs. So freelance writers would often share a fax line with their phone line. And so all day long, I would have to call our freelancers and be like, can you please turn your fax machine on? I'm trying to fax you something. And then I would fax them their galley. And that was like a huge part of my day, which seems so hilariously archaic now. That was like 16 years ago. I started very much at the bottom of the totem pole here. And then I left after a few years and I went on to actually work in book editing. I was a managing editor and a senior editor for several different nonfiction book imprints. And then I ended up coming back to the magazine as editor-in-chief in 2008. And largely part of the reason that they deemed me a good fit for the job is because I had done a lot of things that our readers aspire to do. I've worked in marketing and public relations. I've been a journalist. I've done book editing. So I've done a lot of different kinds of things on the other side of publishing and have just enough knowledge of everything to really relate to our readership of writers and what they are trying to do. Just kind of strike the right tone in what people need to know. So I've been here since 2008 as editor-in-chief, and last year I became editorial director. Our brand portfolio is ever-growing. It's huge. You mentioned the website and the magazine, and we've talked about the books, but we also have large conferences every year. We have online education, online workshops. So it really is just this wealth of information that I am steeped in all day long here. Just reading instruction on how to do these things that I've admired my whole life, kind of eventually wanted to give it a try. And so I started probably about 8 years ago, really seriously pursuing fiction writing on my own. So that's what led to my current position here. I guess that's how it influences my approach to writing. It's always inspiring me to try something new. And I think one of the things I've learned from the magazine is there's this debate in the writing community that comes up sometimes about whether or not writing can be taught. Is it inherent talent or is it something that can be taught? And I think it's both, but it absolutely can be taught. And what I've learned is that writing instruction is so much more valuable if you have a work in progress, if you're actually actively pursuing writing. you can read book after book after article after article and attend classes online and off and in person and conferences, and you could soak up all this information. But when you actually start writing something, that is when little light bulbs are going to go off. Working here, I don't have the option of shutting off the instruction. It's not like I can, well, I'm going to read this book on how to write characters, and then I'm going to set it aside, and I'm going to tune out all that advice, and I'm going to write a novel. I can't do that. When you're in the middle of a novel, and then you're reading an article the next day on ways to incorporate plot twists, and something will just go off in your mind where you read a tip, and you're like, that's it. That's how I solved the problem on the next page. I've really realized how important it is to be pursuing instruction on the craft of writing while you actually have work in progress. The application for it will be so much clearer, and your work will be stronger for it as well.
I'm very familiar with the debate about innate talent versus learned ability. Really was strongly on the first side of the argument when I first started writing. When I was in college, I very much felt that you either could write or you couldn't. It's interesting to me now because that's how I felt about it. And I wrote my first novel when I was in college. And now, 15 years later, I went back and read that first novel that I wrote in college. And I can easily tell you that talent, probably not inherent. I mean, maybe a modicum. You have to start with that little nugget of ability. I think there is an inherent understanding of perhaps plot and pacing. But everything else, I absolutely agree, can be learned. And my thinking on that has changed since I have watched myself improve dramatically. Leaps and bounds from how I wrote in my 20s, even from, I don't read my published novels, but when I read aloud, if I'm reading one of my earlier novels, I will read sections for an audience and be like, oh my gosh, I'm editing as I go. Like, I'm not reading what's on the page. I'm fixing it.
Right. It's worth noting that it's like that with all types of writing too. Sometimes when we're pulling something from our archives for whatever reason in the office, say a writer has passed away or something, and we're going back to pull an old interview, I'll read articles that I wrote for the magazine in 2001 or 2002, and I will just cringe. You know, I can't believe I used that lead or that transition. So I think with all types of writing, you just get better over time. And some of that is practice and some of it is instruction.
I just want to touch on this real quick. This is my own personal curiosity. I'm from Ohio myself, and I have always been absolutely fascinated by the idea that this major touchstone for me as a writer, and also I know many others, and a rather large presence in aspiring writers' lives is in Cincinnati, Ohio. I guess you did kind of answer my question, that it was a family-run business and it was founded in 1920.
Our parent company is called FNW Media. It's a plus sign. And the letters stood for the two publications that they had at the time. The F stood for Farm Quarterly, and the W stood for Writer's Digest. And that's what it was at the time. Farm Quarterly and Writer's Digest.
A random mix.
Yes. And Farm Quarterly is, alas, no longer with us. but the company is still called FNW Media, and now they oversee tons of enthusiast brands for artists, woodworkers, knitters, mixed media artists, fiber artists. So they're really an enthusiast company. And we do have offices all over the country, but the headquarters is still here in Cincinnati.
I'll have to tell my dad that. My dad's a farmer. My whole family is farmers, like all the way back to 1700s. Like,
well, they probably have some back issues. You should look around.
They might. When I am talking to aspiring writers and they're like, how do we get our foot in the door? How do we do this? And I'm like, guys, I'm a farmer's daughter from Ohio. Like, that's how I introduce myself to people. I had no formal training. I had no connections in the industry. I'm just a farmer's daughter. And I made it. Well, we were talking about the debate of talent versus learned instruction. Mm-hmm. And I think the other thing that you absolutely have to have is terribly thick skin and determination. That has to be inborn before you get yourself out there.
Well, first of all, you're right. I'm the granddaughter of a steel mill worker from Pittsburgh. I'm right there with you. The thick skin is tough for me because that's a thing that everyone says, and I'm not sure that mine is all that thick, to be honest with you. I think part of what makes me the sort of writer that I am, which is, I think I kind of write from emotion. I think even if your skin is not inherently thick, it's the ability to just shake off that sting the next day. Mm-hmm. It's not that you have mm-hmm. to not feel it necessarily, but you just have to be doggedly stubborn and persistent, yes. I guess, yes. which I am. So, and I think that's what some people mean when they say thick skin. For me, it's funny because I don't actually think that I am thick-skinned, but I am persistent.
Yes, so. I definitely didn't start out thick-skinned. Like, I remember crying when I got my first rejection, which is ludicrous to me now, but I cried. I got my first rejection in the mail. I was, like, I think 21, 22, and I got my rejection in the mail, and I sat down and cried. Now, of course, that's just funny to me. I get rejected all the time. I got rejection yesterday from a short, you know, for a short. I think you can develop a thick skin, but I think you're right that it is even more important to be able to take the hit and get up and keep going.
Even if you feel it. One of the coolest things about my job here is that I've gotten to interview so many writers who I admire. Bestsellers that we have on our covers. I've done a lot of those interviews. The cool thing about being editor is you can assign the cool things to yourself if you want. I've interviewed Alice Walker, David Sedaris, Anne Tyler. The list goes on. But one of the things is that you talk to these people who seem as if they've achieved so much. And those early days of rejection, and they all still get rejected too, by the way, I think. Mm-hmm. But I think those early days of rejection are still so vivid to them. It's something that, and I think it's part of what makes the writing community so warm and generous to one another, mm-hmm. because everybody can remember really well what it was like to be in those shoes. I remember Brad Meltzer, he's a thriller writer. He writes these like mm-hmm. political conspiracy thrillers, but he also writes these amazing picture books for kids. It's a series called Ordinary People Change the World. And he's also hosted a history series on the History Channel, and he does all kinds of different cool things. But before he had done any of those things, he had a situation where there were different publishers vying for a novel of his, and he thought it was finally going to get published. He basically got this call from his agent that they all were arguing over his book, and they all talked each other out of it, and then nobody...
Oh, my God!
And... I mean, he had like flown to New York from his home in Florida and gone to this dinner with them and everything, and then flew home and was waiting for what the best offer was going to be. And it turned out there was no offer. His agent just said, "Sorry, kiddo." And he just remembered sitting in his office. He was like, "I can remember the Formica, like the crappy Formica of my cheap writing desk. And I can remember seeing the dust particles in the air and like having this corded phone to my ear and just thinking that was it." He was saying that he thinks about that moment still every time he sits down to write. Whatever anyone listening is going through, you're not alone. Wear that rejection like a battle scar. I always celebrated mine. If I get a rejection, that means that I put myself out there. And I should reward myself for that. So for me, no matter what day of the week it was, rejection in my inbox while I'm here at work at Writer's Digest means that night I get to go home and have a glass of wine. Whatever it takes to get through it.
Yeah, so on like a bad day at the office, you're like, "Oh my God, please, I need a rejection so I can go home and drink."
Yeah, now I can't because I'm writing on my next novel deadline every night. Oh. And if I had a glass of wine, it would just put me to sleep. I would just hoard it all. It would be like a rain check for Friday.
You're shot for each rejection. It'd be a new drinking game. It's a writing drinking game. Oh,
exactly.
No one do that because I would be
dead.
That's
probably not a good idea.
Yeah, I would actually have passed away long ago.
I think it's been tried before.
I'm sure it has. Edgar Allan Poe, for example. We do actually have quite a few published authors that listen to the podcast. So do you have any advice for already published writers on how they might get their work in the form of writing advice, essays, nonfiction, into Writer's Digest?
Yes, absolutely. We have an editorial calendar of all the issue themes that we plan to publish in the year ahead in our submission guidelines on our website. So if you go to writersdigest.com/submission guidelines and scroll down where it mentions the editorial calendar, there's a hot link. Just click on that. That tells you the themes, and that doesn't mean that those are the only topics that we are acquiring articles on in the coming year, but those are the topics that we will be focusing on mm-hmm. acquiring articles on in the coming year. We actually get precious few queries specifically for issue themes. Sometimes I actually have to go looking with some of our regular contributors to fill out those issue lineups. So my number one tip would be to pitch to those issue themes. Take into consideration our lead time, which is about 6 months. So right now it's summer, and I'm looking ahead to my November, December, and January issue themes. Pitch to those themes and take into account the lead time. And then even for previously unpublished writers, the easiest place to break into the magazine is our Inkwell department, which is kind of our upfront section. That's often the case with most magazines, where the kind of front of the book shorter features are often the easiest way to land a byline if you've never contributed before. There's also the most flexibility in that Inkwell department. That does not pertain to our issue themes at all. Those themes are just for the features. And we have an essay department inside that Inkwell called 5-Minute Memoir. And there are 600 word reflections on the writing life. They're very short. You could totally do one, Mindy.
Well, I actually sent one in and got rejected.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I did.
Well, to be fair, I don't acquire for that column. It was not me who rejected you.
Okay.
There are 600 word essay reflections on the writing life, and it can be anything. It can be funny, moving. It can be inspirational. Really anything. It's wide open, and you don't need to have any publishing credentials to submit for that in particular.
Mm-hmm. So, I always enjoy that section very much.
I think a lot of people do. It's just kind of a nice little breath of fresh air, and it's always nice to hear a new voice too.
It is, and I think it's lovely to see all of the just continuing themes and the feelings and the emotions that are so constant in almost all writers' lives. I really enjoy the 5-Minute Memoir.
I will say we get a lot of sad ones. So
yeah, see, I said a funny one. I just didn't.
Have a glass of wine.
I did.
Okay. Okay, good. We publish some sad ones sometimes because sometimes they're really good. That's the kind of the type that we get the most of. So anything that isn't depressing would be kind of setting you apart.
Up next, Jessica talks about her novel, Almost Missed You, which deals with miscommunication in relationships, the all-encompassing love of motherhood, and the question of if we truly know our significant other.
Almost Missed You features Violet, the mother who has the most romantic story about how she met her husband, Finn. But when he disappears during a family vacation, taking their toddler son with him, Violet is forced to realize that, great beginning or not, her story might not have a happy ending. I am not a romantic, and I appreciated very much the realistic portrayal of marriage, and especially how motherly love trumps all. So what made you take the approach that you did with this book?
I have always been fascinated by great stories of how couples meet, but I've also been fascinated by the fact that we all are fascinated by great stories of how couples meet. I think as a culture, we actually place a ton of emphasis on that and kind of the surrounding ideas. The idea of fate must have been meant to be. You could attend golden wedding anniversary party and people would be asking, I guarantee you, how that couple met. We're placing some kind of significance on that. It's significant to us for some reason, even though that could be the least significant thing that happened in their 50 years of marriage, was just that they met. I love those stories just like everybody else, but I've also thought a lot about why do we place so much importance on that? And also it raises all the questions of the alternate paths that could have been taken too. Like not just the one, but the one who got away. What if things had happened differently? So I just had this idea that I wanted to take a couple who everybody thinks is fated to be together in that way. I mean, that is their story. And turn the angle on it a little bit and ask if the story as they know it is even the whole truth necessarily. And what happens next? We all love romantic comedies and seeing the whole comedy of errors that can occur in finding the person that you marry, but then the end of the movie is not the end of the story. I just think it's really fascinating. So I wanted to take the idea of fate especially and call it into question. Not just is there such a thing as fate, but do we put too much stock in that and the stories that we tell ourselves?
I think it's a fascinating question. I agree with you entirely about romantic comedies. They usually end in a wedding or a kiss. the credits roll and everyone's happy. And I'm like, yeah, well, show me 6 months later. Show me 6 years later. Show me their first fight over who overloaded the dishwasher. Everyone loves the meet cute, but I enjoy the realism in any book. I also, though, I have to add to that I dislike the long married couple that is bitter and unhappy or just ignoring each other any longer. They're simply roommates. It's just like there gotta be an in-between. Show me a happy, healthy couple that's been together over 10 years. And I know that they're rare, but and probably boring, which is why we don't get that story.
Well, I think that the role, when we talk about fate, a lot of times what we're really talking about is timing, too. Mm. For better or worse, really. And that's something that plays really heavily into the novel, too, where all the right things could almost be in place, but either the timing was exactly right or the timing was maybe not quite right. And I think it's kind of like that in real life, too.
I wanted to talk to you briefly about the angle of motherhood, because that does end up being such a huge theme in the book, and even more important than I think the romantic love in the book was the relationships between the mothers and their children, and how in most cases that was what was driving them more than their husbands. I enjoyed that very much in a book that is about relationships between adults, but you could see that mother card being played where it was just like, no, my kids are the most important thing to me. Always.
The children in the book are very young, too. And that's, I mean, me as a writer, that's where I've been writing mm-hmm. from these past few years. As a new mom myself, that's what I have had on my mind. But also the kind of conversations that I was having with a lot of my friends, too. Especially as a feminist, you don't want to be defined by motherhood when you become a mother, but it does mm-hmm. define you in these amazing ways. And so my kids are 3 and 5 now. And when I was writing this book, they were much younger. They were probably closer to 1 and 3. Of course, in the book, one of the mothers has been separated from her child, and she's just heartbroken. And it's very, very easy to imagine. I think as soon as you become a mom, you automatically become more of a worrier, or at least I did too. And both of the characters in the book kind of experience that as well, where they're just very focused on their children. So Violet's husband has taken off with her child. They're both upsetting, but the fact that the child is gone is way more upsetting.
One of the things that you mentioned is the feminism angle and feeling perhaps a slip of your grip on feminism once you become a mother, but I have seen so many nature documentaries, and when I think of mothers, the first thing I think of is ferocity. I don't think there's anything more dangerous than a mother defending its young. Attack larger animals to keep them safe. I mean, it's just, that's something I always find fascinating, is the strength of motherhood.
I think it is like a primal thing. You can kind of feel it, kind of have your first grizzly bear feeling. It's kind of like, ooh. I didn't know I had that in me. And I think there is something kind of biological about it. I don't know. And maybe it's not losing your grip on feminism. Maybe it's actually strengthening
tapping
it.
In. Cool. Every character in this book has a secret, all of them damaging. Violet learns that not only her husband, but also her best friend and her powerful husband might not be the people she thought they were. So the concept of truly knowing others at their core is a difficult one. Was it your intention to explore this theme in the book, or was it something that arose while you were drafting?
It definitely was my intention to explore that theme. Building on what I said earlier, the whole idea of getting caught up in the narrative that we're telling ourselves about our relationships and our own lives. I was a psych minor in college, and I'll read Psychology Today and follow news in that area, and that's actually something that's been proven that we do. We all construct narratives around our lives to help us mm-hmm. not just communicate them to other people, but to ourselves too. 2 months from now, you won't remember everything you did yesterday, but you might remember an anecdote from that day. Mm-hmm. We can kind of pick and choose, sometimes even without our own knowledge, what we want to tell ourselves. And then what are we omitting from that, whether it's without our knowledge or just something that we're sort of choosing not to see because it doesn't fit in with the narrative. I'm actually teaching a fiction writing class this summer down at the Carnegie Center in Lexington on the concept of acting out of character. I wrote a guest post on this for the blog Writers in the Storm. I think it's such an interesting thing in real life, but also a fictional device, because when a character acts out of character, we question everything. Was this person not who we thought, or did something provoke this seemingly out of character behavior? Or what is going on here exactly? And essentially, that's what happens in Almost Missed You. Finn, who everyone thought was in this perfect relationship and having this perfect life with this healthy young boy and this beautiful wife who they were fated to be together, he takes the child and ups and disappears, and this is wildly out of character. Or is it? I mean, that's what everyone's left wondering. Is this out of character for him? Did something happen to make him snap or act this way? Or did we not know him? Did we not know his character? And I think when someone in a book or in real life acts out of character, that can be a really powerful catalyst for a story because it raises questions, which of course is what keeps readers turning pages. So that's definitely an approach I took to exploring that theme.
Yeah, I think it is a very interesting question because it is very possibly impossible to actually truly know someone completely. I've been with my boyfriend that I'm currently with for 10 years. We still have moments where he'll like a song that I didn't think he would like. Or I'll be like, yeah, I'll watch that movie. That sounds cool. I would like to watch that movie. And he'll be like, really? I didn't think that you would be into that. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting that even after 10 years where we can share looks during other people's conversations, and we absolutely know what the other person is thinking, or finish each other's sentences. And sometimes if one of us can't come up with a word, the other one just goes, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Just keep going. Like, we understand each other, but I don't want to say completely, because we still surprise each other, which is healthy and good, I think. So, like, acting out of the prescribed role that your significant other has given you doesn't always have to be something catastrophic or negative. It can keep things happy and awesome, too. But obviously, that is not a fun novel. That's not a novel with a big plot.
Another thing that I've thought about, and there are small echoes of this in Almost Missed You. So much of our communication now happens through text message or email. Mm-hmm. So much of it is written. And what you lose there is the tone, the intended tone of things. I mean, how many times have we fired off an email that we thought said one thing and then the person on the other end took it a different way? Or sometimes we'll get a text message and we're not really sure how to take it. I had this idea of you're on the same frequency, but the wavelength is off. In Violet and Finn's case, one person could be, there were 1,000 chances for us not to get together, and the one chance that we did get together, and that's how it happened. And the other person could be, there were 1,000 chances for us not to get together, and the one chance, that's how it ended up. The idea that you could be, especially with so much communication happening non-verbally, that you could just be like almost on the same page, but something key is missing there, I think is kind of interesting too.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about tone being lost in text messages. I'll be just out running errands and I'll shoot a text and be like, hey, do you want me to grab you some dinner? He'll just text back, no. And I'm just like, no. He's just answering my question. He fishes a lot, so he could literally be wearing waders being standing in the middle of a lake, and he doesn't want to have his phone out really long, right? She's like, no, you know, puts it away. And I'm just like, no. Tone can be lost, is lost, and misunderstandings arise through
it's true.
So many.
That's a very simple example, but if there are enough of those, I mean, I do find it's kind of terrifying that you could think you're very much on the same page as someone and not be.
Yeah, absolutely. Enough of those little, short, brief texts that are misconstrued by the other person can lead up to this amazing amount of resentment. It's coming from nowhere. It's all internal. It is scary. People are frightening. So I want to talk about the kids. The children in the novel, they are young, as you said. They're very sweet and naive. They have no secrets. I believe there's a point where one of the adults even thinks to themselves, because the child just blurts something, and they're like, that must be so lovely. They're not having to guard themselves at all.
Right.
And they're living their lives in innocence. So was that a purposeful juxtaposition with their parents?
I'm very tapped into that world of really young kids in parenthood right now, just from my own life. So I think it was a purposeful juxtaposition just by the fact that it's true. Mm-hmm. It's often the first thing that you think of when you're a parent, if something bad happens in the mm-hmm. world, whether it's your personal world or even the world at large, how you don't want it to be that way for your kids or how you're going to explain it. And so I think that juxtaposition is just true on so many levels. And it would be impossible to write the story in an authentic way, especially when the adults have gotten themselves into such a mess mm-hmm. as they have in my book, and not have the contrast be kind of striking.
It reminded me in some ways of Little Children by Tom Perrotta.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it reminded me in some ways of that, because you have the adults that are just really messing up their lives and making bad decisions. And the only reason they even have crossed paths is because their kids are friends. This is right. Cute, little, innocent, immediate friendships that arise in children that lead to a relationship between adults that is, you know, catastrophic for a community, even for multiple people. Like, the kids have no idea. It's very interesting to me.
Well, and in the book, the two female point of view characters, we have Violet, who's the wife who's been left, and then we have her mutual best friend with her husband, Caitlin, is a really important character in the book because Finn actually shows up on Caitlin's doorstep very early on with the child and essentially blackmails her into hiding him. And so she's really wrestling with what to do because he's blackmailing her with something that she feels would destroy her own family. And yet mm-hmm. she has this loyalty to Violet. And Caitlin and Violet, their entire friendship is essentially based on motherhood. Caitlin has always been best friends with Violet's husband. But at the same time, the reason Violet and Caitlin became close themselves is because they had newborns within like weeks of one another, and they're on the same street. And when you have this newborn and you're in your own little bubble, you don't know if it's day or night, and you're on the same crazy schedule. They went through all of that together. They were sort of in that little bubble together, and it was this intense bonding experience. And so their entire relationship is basically based on both Violet's husband's history with her and just the fact that they became moms together. Like, that's mm-hmm. it. And then motherhood is obviously the thing that Violet has at stake, because yeah. her child has been taken from her, and Caitlin happens to be the one person who knows where the child is. And so it's just the worst thing that could come between them.
Yeah, I think it's interesting in female friendships, especially if you take, and you kind of alluded to this too, because there was another friend, I believe her name was Katie, that mm-hmm. was not married and was not a mother. And once Violet achieves those things, their friendship kind of cools. And I think you see that often. Once you become a mother, it's such a focus that if you're not a fellow mother, you're not going to understand.
I think some of it is just sheer exhaustion, too.
Yeah, that's true. Know?
Especially in those early days. You don't mean for it to happen. It's not as if you don't want to. Actually, contrary to not wanting to hang out with your single friends anymore, you probably want to, like, more than ever. You mm-hmm. would, like, kill for a night out sometimes, but you're just exhausted, and you are kind of caught in that little bubble, I think, for sometimes like the first year. By the time you come out of it, hey, I want to get back in. You've, of course, completely disconnected yourself.
I want to have you let our listeners know where they can find you on social media. And you had a cover reveal recently for your second book. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what the next book is?
Sure. The next book is called Not That I Could Tell. It is also set in Ohio. It's set in a little town called Yellow Springs.
Yay, I know Yellow Springs.
It's this great, eclectic little town here, but it's a nice kind of confined environment for a small town story, which is what we have in this book. So it kind of raises the question of a friend's role in a situation where domestic violence may or may not be a factor. And it's another alternating point of view character book between three characters. And that will be out in March of next year. My website is jessicastrauser.com. I'm on Facebook at Jessica Strauser Author and on Twitter at Jessica Strauser. And Writer's Digest is, of course, at writersdigest.com and on Facebook and Twitter, both just at Writer's Digest.
Rider, Rider, Pants on Fire is produced by Mindy McGinnis. Music by Jack Corbel. A special thank you to fellow authors Alyssa Palombo and R.C. Lewis, as well as patron Stephen Avery for helping to make this episode possible. If you find the blog or podcast helpful, please consider showing your support by visiting patron.podbean.com/writer writer pants on fire and making a donation. I'm your host, Mindy McGinnis, and we'll be back next week with another episode of Writer Writer Pants on Fire, where authors talk about things that never happened to people who don't exist.